So today, with Sunday number three of the Lenten season, we now cross into what might be called the heart or the core or the kernel of our sacred season of grace and our Lenten walk. Lent has a structure to it, like all of our seasons, very intentional, so today, no exception. How do I mean that? First and second Sundays we've moved through now, and every year they're always the same particular stories. Sunday one in the desert to be tempted and tested, Sunday two up on the mountain to be transfigured, so we did that. But every year Sundays three, four, and five rotate through a particular theme. So we begin today and next Sunday and the one after, three, four, five, this year a particular look on the theme of the dying and the rising. That's the theme of this year's three, four, five cycle. The Paschal mystery, it's often called, the dying and the rising of Jesus. So the church is going to offer us over these next couple of Sundays now in this heart of the season different angles on this idea of what it means to die and to rise, both Christ's own death and resurrection, but also our own. And it does so because this is certainly what Lent is all about, dying and rising. It does so because it's what life is all about, dying and rising. In fact, it's the fundamental movement in the cosmos, death and resurrection, and Christ redeems it by entering right into it to make it a pathway to his heart, to holiness, and to the life of the world to come. So that's what's happening today. We enter into our themed time now of the season, dying and rising. Not only that, special treat, we enter into John's gospel. Leave Mark behind for a little bit. Next couple Sundays, today, the next, and number five, all on John the seer. John's a lovely, beautiful gospel, which must be picked apart very carefully. Much going on in it, right? So that's the roadmap, okay? Then and now and what's ahead. After that, it's Palm Sunday, then it's Easter. And into the Easter glory we go. So to get at this today, okay, dying and rising, Sunday number one, all right? What does the church give us? The story of the cleaning of the temple as John tells it, which is a fascinating little story. And what's going to happen in this story, okay, is that John is going to lay out for us a, I would call it like a movement or a pattern or like a progression, which I'll outline for you in a second, with the idea that the same pattern that Christ kind of follows or walks through in this gospel story is the same one he wants to reenact in our lives over and over again. All right, so gospel story, movement, little microcosm, mini version of our lives over and over again, and Lent is the privileged time to get at that movement, okay? So to that end, a little bit about the gospel. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, just like John, all have this story of the cleaning of the temple, the cleansing of the temple. Matthew, Mark, and Luke put it later in their text. John has it right off the bat in the beginning. What does Jesus do in all the cases, no matter which one you look at, which version? He comes to the temple. And the temple for the Jews, okay, especially in this time period, would be the heart of their nation. This is where sacrifices are offered, where the prayers are given over, where sins are taken away for the nation and even for the world. It's a place where the cosmos aligns around the altar in the Holy of Holies, the sanctuary. And it is the place, as far as Jews understand it, where the living God dwells. He lives among his people in the temple. So it is precious to him and precious to them, a very, very sacred and lovely place. Jesus is drawn there as a pilgrim for Passover. This is his first Passover in John's gospel. Two more will follow. The last will be Good Friday. And when he goes and he gets there, he discovers something that does not sit well with him. He discovers the practice of the economics of the temple, okay? Now, to be fair to the people of the time period, this idea of exchanging money, which he encounters, this idea of selling oxen and sheep and goats, those were essential practices of the operation of this large building and institution. Sacrifices weren't free, you had to pay for these animals, so he runs into what's become an established part of the temple's machinery. But over time, like everything else in the world that has fallen, things become corrupt, crusted over, unfair, unfortunate, and unjust. And what he sees, he does not like. So out of love for his father's house, out of love for the place where his father dwells, out of his drawing to the sacred space, he looks around and says, what's impure here must go. So like the prophets before him who loved the temple, out of love for it, he purifies it. He drives out what does not belong there. He says, my Father's house is not for these things. It's not for injustice. It's not for earthly gain. It is for worship. It's where heaven and earth meet. It's my Father lives. What does not belong must go. And out he drives it with fury, with righteous anger. It's a very powerful scene. So he encounters God's dwelling place and desires to purify it. When he does so, the apostles don't know how to take this. They think about Psalm 69 and about zeal consuming someone for the house of God, thinking to themselves, well, this will get him killed. So that's how they understand the whole thing, and they would be right. The Jews, first time we meet them in John's text is in this particular opening scene, those would be those who run the temple. They question Jesus, and they say, what sign can you show us that you have the right to do this? They don't say, don't do that. They don't say he's wrong, but they simply say, who are you? From where do you come? What does this mean? Explain yourself, teacher. So what does he do? He says, you want a sign? Here's my sign. Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. The dying and the rising. There it is in our paschal cycle, huh? He knows he's talking about his body. The apostles have figured that out later. The Jews do not understand what he's trying to say, and they can't possibly. Who can even know? It's a mysterious thing to say. They thought he meant the building. Of course, he says, no, I'm talking about me. Why does he do this? So he moves into God's house. He purifies it because he's trying to move the Jews and the world to a new place in worship. Because he understands that the temple's time has come to an end. It's coming to an end. He understands that now God is going to take his sacred dwelling place made of stone and replace it with something else, with someone else, with the Son of Man, who is God's temple among men, where God dwells forever. He's going to replace all the sacrifices of the altar of animals with the sacrifice of the only begotten Son. That's going to replace it now. And he'll do that so that Christ can move into the hearts of people everywhere and make the church, the living, breathing body, the new temple of God for the entire human race until the end of time when heaven and earth come together at the second coming and his temple is completed forever and ever. That's what's going on in the story. It's all these different movements. He meets God's house, he purifies God's house because he loves it, and because he doesn't want to stay where it's at, he has to move it somewhere to its next logical step. He knows it's going to come to an end. They do not. He knows it's replaced. They do not. Sure enough, history is going to show him to be right in so many respects. But 40 or so years after the story, in the year 70, when Christ has already been crucified and raised, the Romans will come in. There'll be a fight in the city, and long story short, the Romans will destroy, completely destroy this building, this massive building. They will not leave one stone upon another. All gone it will be. End of the temple. Christ knew its days were numbered. You might say that God does this all the time in history. He kind of allows things for a while because he knows that we need it. It works for a bit, and then when it's time for it to go, he takes it away. On to the next thing. So that's the movement, okay? Christ meets his dwelling place, loves his dwelling place, purifies it because he wants to push it to the next level, to a place where the new temple can be born. That's the movement in the story, among others, but that's where we'll land for today anyhow. That very movement, okay, is what plays itself out in Lent and in life over and over again. Same movement. How so? It's Christian theology. It's how we view ourselves to understand that every single baptized person on the planet, you and me and those seeking baptism this time of the year, is a temple, is a dwelling place of God, is a place where the Most High lives. He wants to walk the corridors of our hearts and move inside of us and live in us and animate us and make us full of his life. We are the temple of the living God. Just like in the story, Christ comes to us, looks at us, and like the Jerusalem temple, he wants to purify it. He wants nothing unclean inside of us. If whatever is there that is wrong, it has to go. He wants it driven out of love for it. Out of love for me and you, he says, I will not leave you like you are. Out of love for you, you cannot stay the same. Now, like those money changers and customs, they were not bad things necessarily, but the time had come. He looks at me, looks at you, and says, you know, there's things in your life that might not be bad per se, but they've grown old or inaccurate, or they're not accurate or complete anymore. He says to me and you, how you view yourself, how you view me as God, how you view the world, how you view each other, those things have to change. Your behaviors have to change. Old habits, bad habits, sinful things, addictions, attachments, tendencies, God says, cast them out. They must go out of your lives and out of your world. If I'm going to live in you in my fullness, things have to go. And it's going to hurt. Just like in the story, this turned some heads, started some arguments. So it is with us too. When God comes into us and takes things out that we're attached to, it's painful for us. But it happens all the time. Why? Because he wants to move us to a new place. He will say to all of us, you know, this temple that is your body, like the Jerusalem temple, one day it's going to be destroyed in its earthly sense. Your bodies are good, but you're going to die. You have your mortal creatures. So to ensure that you will live forever, that you'll rise on the last day, I'm going to fill you with my divine life. Indestructible, immortal life. I'm going to breathe it into you. But you won't survive the passage from death to life if there are impure things in you. So, like in the gospel, I come to your house, I clean it out, I drive things that don't belong to move you to a new place where you will live forever and you will rise when you die. This is the dying and the rising, okay? Dying to sin so we can rise in fullness of grace, even the dying of our bodies to rise in fullness of life because Jesus has moved into us permanently. The old order has to go, the new order will remain. That's the movement in the gospel and in our lives. How does he do it? We're given some clues. What are his whips of cords? What are his tools of choice? How does he push us along and clean us and transform us into a living temple and leaving the old ones behind? The first clue is the first reading, Exodus, the commandments. The commandments are God's gift to his people to show us how to cast out of our lives what doesn't belong there anymore. God must be first. His name must be honored. His day must be honored. The persons around us must be honored. Our passions and appetites must be mastered. It's a lifelong process. The commandments mean death, as in death to things that don't belong, as in death to sin and bad habits and poor attachments and poor thinking and false ideas and false systems and false economies and false societies, death to all that. The commandments mean death to all the things that are opposed to God's reigning in our hearts. Why? So we can rise full of grace, full of life, full of goodness, honor and dignity, and a better world order, a just world order. That's how he drives things out. He gives us the law and says, observe these things. Because I love you, out of love for me, observe them back. That will cleanse your temple, you as persons, and your entire world. But also, and here's why these readings come during Lent, okay? The Lenten practices of prayer, fasting, and almsgiving are also very powerful tools for cleansing of the temple, that is you and me and of our world. Because when I choose and you choose deliberately to fast or to pray especially or to give things away in generosity, I'm opening myself up, I'm exposing myself to God's power. To pray especially is to say to God, I'm not afraid of you acting in my life. To pray is to engage in the act of allowing him to walk into the temple, that's my heart and my life, and mess it all up, and turn the tables over, and drive things out. So if I'm a person of prayer, and you are too, it should not surprise me that things are going to happen in life that are going to unsettle me, push me, break me, let's just say it, kill me, so that God can raise me newly created. So prayer and fasting, especially in almsgiving, give God permission to go to work on my temple and your temple. That's how it works. It exposes me to his power. It's an open door. Come on in, God. My prayer means you're welcome to do with me as you need to. It's hard. It's painful. Nobody likes going through it. But to go through it, though, is to trust, like in this gospel story, that even if I don't always get it, there is an end that we're going toward. There must be something greater. Jesus tries to get him to see it in the gospel story, but they're not going to see it that early on. They will eventually. Same thing for us. He tells us, you know, look, when you're going through what's hard, when you're going through the ups and downs and the roller coaster and the change is coming and the temple's getting purified, you're going to want to give up. You're going to be frustrated. It'll be difficult. You've got to hang on to the hope of the new life that I'm offering you and trust that I know what I'm doing and I'm leading you somewhere new. When that temple was gone, the Jews didn't know what to do with it. It was an earthquake for their community. The Christians understood something new had come. Couldn't have imagined at the time, but when it came, they realized that's what he was trying to do. He knew it all along. We just had to trust him. So it is with us. Lent, life, dying and rising, dying and rising. To be purified, strengthened, pushed, brought to a new place, full of God's life so that death cannot rob us, but in fact pushes us into the new life that we must get to only through death, physical death. All that awaits us if we let God act upon us, go to work upon us, the commandments work upon us, the prayers, the fast and the almsgiving, it pushes us to be the new temple, the new living dwelling place of God the Most High, so that he can dwell in our world and not just in us as individual persons. This time of the year, we had to tell God, I'm not afraid of that. Welcome it. Bring it on. Won't be easy. It'll be hard. But we know it's going to lead us, the dying and the rising, to a new place. And grace and goodness and the fullness of life that God wants for all of us, his beloved sons and daughters, his beloved dwelling places.